Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Paul Theroux. Theroux is an iconic writer of over 47 books of fiction and nonfiction. Most of his work takes the form of travel writing, a genre he has helped define for the 20th and 21st centuries. He was a global citizen long before such a term even existed. It was his 1975 travelogue, The Great Railway Bazaar, which recounted his passage by train from London to Southeast Asia, by way of the Middle East and India, and back again on the Trans-Siberian Railway, which brought him to international prominence. Theroux has continued to publish travel books recounting his epic train journey in his 2008 book, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, and his latest novel, The Lower River. Now, from Portland Arts and Lectures in 1988, here's Paul Theroux speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
This is my first time in Portland, and it proves something that I've always felt about travel writers. When a travel writer thinks of going somewhere, he thinks of Bangkok or Turkey or Central Africa or the Solomon Islands, but not Portland. And yet, Portland is probably 100 times more interesting. I'm a fresh air fiend. I live in England for about half the year. And this is really a great place to live, would be a great place to live for me, because I'm interested in kayaking and rowing. And that's a great sport. The Columbia River has a lot of kayakers and rowers. So I'd be very happy here. One time the New York Times asked me, I should say parenthetically, when people say, where would I like to travel? I don't say Bangkok and Central Africa. I actually am of the opinion that the real destinations and the places where one might make discoveries are unlikely places and possibly nearer home. And the New York Times asked me what I wanted to do once in terms of writing an article, and I said that I'd like to go home and write a travel article about where I grew up. And they said, what's so special about that? And I said, well, I do it in the winter. I live on Cape Cod, and in the winter, no one goes to the beach. It's very snowy, icy. And they said, well, what's the gimmick? I said, just do it when no one else is doing it and see what happens. And actually, I decided to take my kayak from my home on a beach to Plymouth, which is about 35 miles away by sea. And I saw things that I had never seen before, including 17 seals. And no one knew that when there are no people swimming in the water, you see a lot of unexpected things, including seals. So that doesn't sound like a great thing, but when you come from a crowded place, a megalopolis, where you're full of people and cars and so forth, then you see a wild animal, a happy wild animal, that no one is eating. It's quite an unusual thing. I was recently in China. In fact, I'm going to speak about China tonight. That's my subject, which I'm going to get to in a moment. And I was thinking that every time you do see rare birds in China, but the people are usually stuffing them into their mouths. And the other ones are sparrows. My subject actually is travel writing, as you might have guessed by now. And In the course of my writing life, I've written four or five books that could be regarded as travel books. I don't regard a book like The Mosquito Coast or the books I wrote that are set in Africa or The London Embassy, even though it's set in England, as travel books. They have a background which is based on travel or residence in a foreign location, but they don't have anything to do with travel. They have, I think, more to do with character. In a travel book, the character might be either the person writing the book or the people in the country where the person is traveling. Travel writing is often a form of autobiography and has nothing to do with the place that the person appears to be writing about. Mark Twain, for example, when he wrote Innocents Abroad and Following the Equator, was essentially making jokes, writing about himself. Mark Twain used to... He made a whole career, actually, about giving lectures about the Sandwich Islands, about Hawaii, where he spent some time, just talking about the odd habits of people. But essentially, he was a stand-up comic. And he talked about himself, but Mark Twain was able to talk about himself very well. But then there are other travel writers, and I would include among them the English explorer Wilfred Thesiger. Some of you might have heard of him. He wrote a book called Arabian Sands, and also Desert, Marsh, and Mountain, and a book called The Marsh Arabs. Well, essentially, does it ring a bell, Wilfred Thesiger? Possibly yes, possibly no. But he's a great explorer, a man who went by camel all over Arabia, making maps, and he lived in Ethiopia, and a very resourceful traveler. You know nothing about the man, except that he's brave and very tough. You don't know anything about his private life. You know nothing about his background or education. You don't even know about things he likes or doesn't like. Thesiger, as a traveler, is so tough that he doesn't admit to wanting things that he can't have. He doesn't say, I long to have a beer or a steak, or I wished I wanted a good hot shower. He's usually traveling with Bedouin, often for months at a time. And one of his memorable trips was not only starving to death, but dying of thirst with two other Bedouin. And he said to them, when he was absolutely at the end of his tether and had nothing to drink, what should we do if we don't find any water tomorrow? And they said, well, we'll ram a stick down the camel's throat, and when he vomits, we'll eat it. Because that's what the Bedouin do when things... I should quickly say, he didn't do this. They found water the next morning. But that's in the way of culinary treats. That's all you know of Wilfred Thesiger. Then there are other... there's a book called The Worst Journey in the World, which is one of my favorite books. Does that ring any bell? The Worst Journey in the World, which is, I assure you, one of the best travel books ever written, is about Scott's expedition to the South Pole in 1913 to 1916. And... it's written by a man who was very young at the time. He was about 25. And the Worst Journey is not Scott's exploration and trip to the pole, which ended in, as you know, Scott's death and the death of four other men. But it's the journey that this man took in the middle of winter, the Antarctic winter, when it's pitch dark, for 6 weeks to a distant promontory, where there were three men traveling, pushing sledges, with no dogs, but pushing sledges over crevices and so forth, in the dark and the cold, when it was minus 79 degrees, he says, Fahrenheit, with the wind blowing, to find out what the emperor penguin did in the winter. Because it was dark, and because no one had ever seen an emperor penguin breeding, they didn't know where these strange creatures, probably the first birds on Earth, I mean, the most primitive bird on Earth, they didn't know what happened to them. And are you interested to know what they do in the winter? They went and your eyes grow accustomed to the dark, of course, in the Antarctic night. And after 3 weeks, it was 3 weeks there and 3 weeks back, they reached the shelf of ice and looked down, and there were the emperor penguins, all male. There were no female penguins there. And they realized that the female penguins laid eggs and swam away. And the egg was adopted by the male penguin, who put the egg on top of his feet to keep it off the ice, and then crouched on it. And then all the emperor penguins squashed together to keep warm in this freezing cold and dark, and just squawked all winter and didn't eat. Then they did that for 3 months. In the spring, the female penguins swam back. Anyway, this the worst journey in the world, therefore, is a quest for a penguin's egg. And it defined a penguin's egg. And when they brought it back to England, they put it in the man in the British Museum put it in a drawer, and no one looked at it. And these men had risked their lives. Actually, one of them died on the trip. So it's strange. And the author of this book is called Apsley Cherry Garrard. Is very funny and a very, very good writer. But similarly, you know nothing about him. This isn't the autobiographical book. You know, a lot of people are writing travel books now, but the autobiographical books with a lot of personality, are just one kind. But the other kind, the kind which describe, as I say, an ordeal, for example, the ordeal book, is, well, but I think, to my mind, much, much more interesting. I would much rather read an account, say, of, well, Shackleton's voyage, also in Antarctic, or although it's not technically a travel book, a book where people go out in a boat, it tips over, and they survive the ordeal of an open boat, the open boat journey. I find that amazingly interesting because you discover what people need in order to survive, and the ordeal tells a great deal about human requirements, let's say, or what people need in order to keep body and soul together. And sometimes they're usually spiritual quests as well, because you can't suffer without finding something spiritual about yourself. And then there are scientific travel books which, in quest of a certain, like there's a book called The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson, where they're looking for this very elusive endangered species, the snow leopard. That's another type, that's scientific, but it's also spiritual. There's another kind. I think that, by the way, that I've written sort of autobiographically, and I don't know where I've written as an ordeal, but sometimes travel is an ordeal. Just being away from home, being homesick is an ordeal. But I've also hoped that I've written travel books which are a kind of discovery. And I think that it's impossible to write anything, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, whether it's a travel book or a novel, in which there's no discovery. If you're writing something and you're not discovering something about yourself or something about the people that you're writing about, or if you're traveling in a place and you're not discovering something about the place that you're traveling in, then it's almost a worthless enterprise. There's no point in going on, and you might as well go home. Or if you're writing a story and you're not discovering something, and I mean discovering something every day, you begin writing where there's some kind of illumination, then I think there's no writing. Because I think that, for better or worse, all writing is about discovery. And all travel is about discovery, too. It might be self-discovery, or it might be revelation of character. And in that way, writing a novel and writing a travel book are quite similar. They're quite similar, because you're looking for something, and you suspect that there's something there. If writing a novel, there is the nature of characters that is revealed to you in the process of writing. Almost as if it's a form of prayer, although I know it's not a form of prayer, but almost as if that's the case. And then in travel, it's being in a place and being curious enough and interested enough so that you get to know people and find things out. Otherwise, as I say, it seems a fruitless endeavor. Otherwise, perhaps, that's the difference between a vacation and travel. If you're not discovering anything, then it's a vacation. A vacation is kind of horizontal, you know, soaking up the sun. And anyway, a vacation is a sort of horizontal or sedentary thing where you go to a place and they make you feel right at home. Travel, you never feel right at home. If you write at home, there's nothing to write about anyway. We know that. Or travel can be a form of revisionism, which is a Chinese way of saying that you change your mind. And in this spirit, actually, I went to China. I had been to China before, and in that first visit to China in 1980, I thought it was one of the most depressing places I had ever seen in my life. I thought that it was like, it was the way the world was going to end. That when there were too many people, too much pollution, too much acid rain, factories belching smoke, no fuel oil, and people simply living this, like bees in a beehive or ants in an anthill, that was the best, that was the highest stage of poverty, let's say. That was the most decency that you could muster, but at the same time, not a life that was desirable. And I went to China then, 1980, when I was writing The Mosquito Coast, and a lot of The Mosquito Coast was informed by seeing the way people were living then. What I didn't know then was that that was the hangover of the years of Chairman Mao, and that China had had a long history that had culminated in the declaration of China as a republic, of course, in 1911, but then in 1949 becoming what in their terms are liberated from, also in their terms, colonial or imperialistic. Well, the Chinese word is imperialists and they're running dogs, but we're all running dogs so in Chinese mythology. I think that I suspected that China was going to continue in that vein. And my brother, who goes to China a lot, said China's changing in 81, 82, 83. Chairman Mao died in 1976, and Zhou Enlai, who was the next most important man, died later in that year, the same year, 76. And 76 was the end of the Cultural Revolution. Now, I was told that things were changing. When I suspected that perhaps I was wrong and that China was changing, then I saw that as a great opportunity to go and not write about myself, but write about China.
You're listening to a talk by Paul Theroux. He spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1988. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and we'll have more with Theroux after this break. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. Back to a talk with travel writer Paul Theroux now. He spoke in Portland in 1988. This is one of the earliest recordings of Portland Arts and Lectures.
I took a train from London to Paris, Paris to Berlin, to Warsaw, Moscow, then to Siberia, the Trans-Siberian, and then I took a train which is called the Trans-Mongolian train that goes from Siberia, Irkutsk, to Ulaanbaatar and the People's Republic of Mongolia, and then goes into Inner Mongolia, which is a Chinese province, and then it goes at last, about a month later, after leaving London, gets to Peking. I thought, good idea. And that was an inspired choice because I realized that Warsaw, afterwards, it was in terrible trouble. Food was very scarce. Money had been was devalued. Inflation was very high. And it was... There were acute shortages of things, and shortages were very obvious. This was also true in Moscow, also true in Siberia. People come up, they say, would you sell me your track shoes, sell me your T-shirt? You know, it's not everywhere that people want to buy your underwear, but Mongolia, they wanted to buy things like, you know, ballpoint pens and also T-shirts and so forth. But in China, coming through overland, through all this poverty and inflation and scarcity and deprivation, but you know, metropolitan deprivation. People in the Soviet Union are doing all right, but they would like it. There are such a thing as rising expectations. They would like a bit more. They want Reeboks. They don't want just Russian shoes. Their tastes have been refined by the number of people who go there. Or you know, transistor radios or whatever. They actually do want cassette recorders and things like that. And they can only buy them either with hard currency or from tourists who come through. So, but the Chinese couldn't care less. They have all the radios or sneakers and so forth. They would like a little more, a little less censorship, let's say. The students would like a little more freedom of choice. But T-shirts and sneakers are not among the things that they're pining for. And it's very odd. I was on a train where a man had four or five rolls of toilet paper. And I said, "Why? That's interesting. Got this toilet paper. There's no toilet paper shortage in the Soviet Union." He said, "Yes, but we're going to China." And I had been reading a series of books by a professor, Joseph Needham, who might ring a bell with some of you, but anyway, he read a book called, or a series, which is projected to be 25 volumes, called Science and Civilization in China. It's the Cambridge History of China. And as a matter of fact, the Chinese invented toilet paper and perfume toilet paper at that, in the Ming Dynasty. And I made a list of things that the Chinese, I won't bore you with the whole list, but I mean, the Chinese invented the mechanical clock, then they forgot that they invented it, and missionaries reintroduced it to China. They invented cast iron and steel, the plow. They were the first people to notice that snowflakes have six sides. They invented the umbrella, the seismograph, phosphorescent paint, the spinning wheel, calipers, porcelain, the magic lantern, the stink bomb, the crossbow. They invented the crossbow in the first century AD, and they were still using it in 1895, just before the Boxer Rebellion. They invented the hang glider, a sort of man-flying kite. You name it. Everyone knows that they invented gunpowder and playing cards and fireworks. We knew that. You knew that. But you didn't know that they invented... they were the first people in the world to have boats with rudders. That Europeans used oars. They steered boats with oars, steering oars. They introduced stirrups into Western Europe. Before the advent of stirrups, Europeans ran around where they had a sort of choking bridle on a horse, and they just sort of held on. So you could say that because of the stirrup allowed the age of chivalry to develop, because if there weren't stirrups, there wouldn't have been jousting matches, and actually there wouldn't have been much horse riding either. And so you know that the Mongols invaded Europe and fought Poles and Germans. And in the 13th century, there were Mongols on the border of Germany. And then they heard of the death of Genghis Khan, and they went back, and that was that. But they had conquered most of the known world. The Chinese, just to I'll pursue a bit further, because I think you didn't know that the Chinese invented wallpaper, and that French missionaries brought wallpaper to Europe in the 15th century, the idea of wallpaper. They made everything out of paper. I suppose the really interesting thing that I found in China is that they're the last people in the world still manufacturing steam locomotives. Every other country has stopped making them. Now but the Chinese, who are frugal people and have a lot of coal in China, decided that they should continue making steam locomotives, and they do in two places in China. And they're the old black choo-choo trains that until about, the late 50s, I guess, mid or late 50s, we saw. I'm sure they were chugging around Oregon and all over the West. They certainly were in Medford, Massachusetts. They still make them, and there are still sort of people shoveling coal and so forth on them. And they still use them. I mean, on the mainline route. So you might take a four-day trip from Peking to Urumqi in the West, where I went, and you would be pulled by a steam locomotive. They also have electric trains, and they have diesels, to be fair. But certainly for that they found the train to be a very economical way of getting from place to place. So this ingenuity was another thing that I noticed, and I must say, I found riveting. And then I found it very interesting that the Chinese almost don't exist as a people. The Chinese aren't, there's no one that you could say is a typical Chinese person. I'm generalizing about the Chinese in a sort of ridiculous way, but no more ridiculous than when people talk about Americans, and that includes, you know, all sorts of people. But the Chinese include 55 minorities, you know, that's 65 or 70 million people who are anything. There might be, you know, there are millions and millions of Muslims. There are who are a distinct ethnic minority. There are Russians, there are Uzbeks, Tajiks, there are Kazakhs, you know, Cossacks in Western China, Tibetans, and little, you know, what they think of as small groups of colorful people who wear, you know, colorful costumes and funny hats, who dance for tourists, do traditional dancing and whatnot. Little who live in the hills of Yunnan and on the Burmese border, on the Laotian border, in near Vietnam and so forth. So that when you think of the Chinese, the Han Chinese are merely one people in a nation which greatly resembles the United States in its diversity, and which has people, Mongols, Uyghurs, the Uyghur people, about 7 or 8 million, who are Muslims and don't, I mean, they exist entirely on their own, but they've lived in Central Asia for thousands of years, and they've been subject to a lot of migrations and conquered maybe 6 or 7 times by different marauding hordes. So, and this is just, I mean, to a lot of Uyghur people who live in Turfan and Urumqi in the Xinjiang desert, the Han Chinese are just another occupying power. The Tibetans regard the Chinese, or let's say the Peking government, as a sort of occupying force too. So I'm sure you've read things in the paper to that effect. I also thought that going to China, that for the purpose of travel, that I should go as far and wide as possible, and that I should go to the coldest, the hottest, the highest, the lowest, to Tibet, and to the very edges of China, as well as to classical China, to Shanghai and Peking. I can report to you that I had no trouble doing so. I spent a lot of time on the train. There are trains go everywhere in China. You can go to the distant corners. It's not very expensive. There are sleeping cars. The one point that I would make is that which is, I suppose, the most memorable thing in China is the crowding. Is that if all sleeping cars on trains have 4 berth compartments, a compartment with 4 beds in it, and those 4 beds are always occupied. And it might be a honeymoon couple and a little old lady and me, or 2 soldiers and an old man and me, or 3 girls and me, or four men, say, or 2 traveling salesmen. It could be anyone. Or it might be foreigners. They often put foreigners together. But if they see you, that you are a foreigner, that they think you might be happier with another foreigner. But I think that one of the most useful things that happened to me was that I was put in with all different sorts of people from different walks of life, all of whom were very candid and very talkative. And one of the most memorable things about it was that I found the Chinese candid and not necessarily talkative, but they could be formal and polite and extremely courteous, but they told the truth. If you ask them something, whether it was about the government or their lives or about their aspirations, they told me frankly what they felt. That was different from 1980, from 7 years before, when I had been there, when people were very guarded and even said things like, owing to the success of the great proletarian cultural revolution, and under the leadership of the great helmsman, Chairman Mao, we found ourselves at this. Now they say, well, Chairman Mao was a bit made a lot of mistakes, is what they say, and that the 10 years of the Cultural Revolution were turbulent and full of conflict and set China back. So I was grateful for their for that sort of candor. What I found strange, some of you may have been to China, and I don't know whether you would agree with me or not, but I found, even at the best of times, I'm not a sightseer, but I found sightseeing in China something of a disappointment. I think because the Chinese, as a nation, are so keen on patching, fixing, painting, that when you see something in China which is ancient, it doesn't look ancient. It actually has a sort of Disneylandish, outlandish, Disneylandish look, and has no aura of. It doesn't look. You have no vibration of age or of anything venerable. The exceptions, of course, are the Great Wall of China and I suppose the Forbidden City and the Terracotta Warriors. But in between, there are so many other sites that it's very strange. They don't look old, and they don't. The sites are not. They don't get your pulse racing. Not mine. I think it's because the Chinese are great menders. Chairman Mao preached frugality. He said that there was a. I mean, he had a, there. One of the thoughts of Chairman Mao, which I have written here, is that he said that. Thrift should be the guiding principle in our government expenditure. Corruption and waste are very great crimes. People were punished for wasting things in Mao's time. Never be wasteful, he said. In fact, there's a. I carried around this little book, The Thoughts of Chairman Mao, and I used to quote it to people. Anyway, that's in Building Our Country Through Diligence and Frugality. I know that he was an old tyrant. But some of the things were not. I mean, they're so contradictory. I remember saying to people, Mao said there's a serious tendency toward capitalism among the well-to-do peasants. This tendency will become rampant if we, in the slightest way, neglect political work among the peasants during the cooperative movement, and for a very long period thereafter. And they'd say, "Oh my God, where did you get that book?" They'd say, because no one has one in China. Anyway. They don't admit to having them. At the time of the Cultural Revolution, there were 70 million portraits of Chairman Mao on the wall, and many, many more copies of this. I never saw this book in China, never saw one. And when I took it out, you know, it was, I don't know, it was like taking out a book written by Benedict Arnold, you know, in the United States. Very embarrassing. But Mao, anyway, Mao occasionally, this idea of mending, not everything he said was wrong. In fact, many of the things that he said were very wise. And this idea of waste, there are many countries that could profit by this sort of, you know, this idea that waste is a crime. Waste is a crime. It's a crime against other people. And someone's got to dispose of the waste. But the Chinese take great pride. I think that in patching clothes, patching their shoes, cobbling shoes, fixing things, so that if you look under the hood of a Chinese car and under a bus or under a sink, and you see, look at the pipes, you see that's also things are patched, they're held together with bits of string and so forth, and there are always operations in the paper. I think it has its reflection in medicine, that the great triumphs in medicine are. If a person loses an arm and a leg, they take the arm and the leg, and usually there's not enough either for an arm or a leg, but they make one arm out of the arm and the leg. In fact, I actually have a clipping here, but I won't read it to you. But it's transplanted leg saves girl's arm. The sights themselves might not be interesting, but the way they're fixed, the way they're patched, is interesting. During the Cultural Revolution, 3 miles of the Great Wall of China were torn down to build army barracks. Because they said, you know, during the Cultural Revolution, they said that all things really are no good. Confucius was a bad teacher, and he taught kindness and compassion. And forgiveness, Mao said, was not really a good thing. What you really should do is... Mao wrote an essay on going too far. He said, to right a wrong, it is necessary to exceed the proper limits. There's an old Chinese dictum that says you must not exceed proper limits when righting a wrong. Mao said, no, on the contrary. If you kick a landlord out of his house, you must not just ignore him and send him on his way. You should put a paper hat on his head and make him recite, I am a snake spirit and a cow demon. I am, in other words, a kind of monster. Then you should sleep in his bed and march him down the street and humiliate him. In that way, the wrong is righted. Anyway, that was a Maoist dictum. The essay is called On Going Too Far, which he was in favor of, as I say. And that's also why, during the Cultural Revolution, people did do things to excess, things that they're deeply ashamed of now, and more or less have blamed on just the Gang of Four, but everyone was involved in it. Anyway, I started to say that the Great Wall of China was, they started to tear it down, to rip it down, saying, what use is this? It's not keeping out the Mongolian hordes anymore. It was built by an emperor that the Chinese vilified, the Emperor Shi Shi Huang, who also decreed that the terracotta warriors should be built. He also burned all the books in the kingdom. So he said, history is going to begin with me. That was the Qin dynasty. Anyway, they ripped the wall down. I thought it was interesting to look at where the wall had been torn down and what barracks had been built. Actually, the men who built the barracks, these sort of dormitories out of the wall, using the bricks from the wall, because it was waste is a crime. So if you take wall, if you tear the Great Wall of China down, you should use the bricks for something. Those same soldiers then rebuilt the wall. So it's quite a strange little cycle of building a wall, then tearing the wall down, then building barracks, then tearing the barracks down, then building the wall again. And as the Chinese said, it can set you back. people in China remark on the food. Well, of course, food can be memorable, and you can have bowel-shattering meals. But the Chinese tend to a great meal is regarded as something like a bear's paw or a caribou's nose or fish lips, something. Nutrition isn't the first thing that springs to mind, but maybe some sort of association with them. But you can. I'm not a vegetarian, but I'm a sort of meat avoider. I think a lot of people are meat avoiders these days, without being spiritual vegetarians. Anyway, Chinese vegetables are very good. I noticed so the food didn't leave a deep impression on me, except that I remember telling a lot of people. Or asking people, why are you eating this owl? They would have a little owl in a cage, and I'd say, why are you going to eat this owl? And they'd say, owls are good for your eyes. And I said, well, this is that's a very unenlightened thing. Owls catch mice. They're very, very helpful, cute little things. And why are you eating it? Anyway, they were good for your eyes. I said, that's a ridiculous idea. But several times I found, there used to be a festival in China called the Liberation of Living Creatures, where people would just let birds go. So a number of times I went to a restaurant and bought an owl, and the man would say, how do you want it, fried, roasted? I said, no, I think I'll let it go. And so I took it outside and gave it its freedom. And then when they said, is that an American custom? I'd say, no, that's the Liberation of Living Creatures. One of the a Chinese emperor used the liberation of living creatures with that phrase to describe. He used to take criminals from prison and fit them with wings and hand gloves, and said, he'd say, you can jump off this tower, and if you survive, then you can have your freedom. And he was the first. It was the great kite flying period. About. He was the man who actually developed the first parachute in China, according to Professor Needham. I found that I kept noticing people spitting, And everyone's complaining about it. And they said, isn't it terrible the Chinese spit so much? I said, that really isn't my objection that they spit so much. It's that they're not very good at it. And there are so many people in China, people don't, it's not propulsion. They don't spit out like that. They spit sort of down on your foot. And so it wasn't the fact of it, it was the way. And there was always a great wind-up, people clearing their throat and everything. And so there's something very anticlimactic about the actual expectoration. So anyway, I noticed that, though. In other words, I remember the kindness. I remember the crowds, the spitting, the laughter. There's a kind of laughter. Chinese laughter never seemed to be about humorous things. It was a laugh that said, ha-ha, don't ask me any more questions, or ha-ha, that was a very embarrassing one, or ha-ha, it's going to be absolutely impossible for you to do that. It was never, ha-ha, that's funny. And it usually meant not in your life. So this is it's not enough to learn Chinese, you also have to learn about the noises that that people make. And there are new people in China, there are new there are lawyers in China now, and accountants, and bankers, and people training other people how to make 10-speed bicycles and Kentucky Fried Chicken. But the newest role in China, the newest sort of trade, I think, and the most noticeable were taxi drivers. Taxi drivers all over the place. They were the people who had access to foreigners. They had foreign currency, the foreign exchange certificates, and they had the most mobility and the most freedom in the society. I thought Chinese taxi drivers were a whole new breed of people, in a way like American lawyers who were sort of making their own rules. And you say, who's that man, you know, dancing? Who goes to the discotheque? They say taxi drivers. Who gets their hair curled? They say taxi drivers. I said, man, taxi drivers? Yes. There was a fad for having a permanent, and the taxi drivers did that too. The taxi drivers were the first people, in my experience, to ask for tips. Tipping is not allowed in China, but a taxi driver had the temerity to ask me for a tip. And I said, no one asks for a tip in China. And he actually said, but I'm a taxi driver. Well, another, and I suppose the two, and I will close in this, the two most vivid experiences I had were first the experience of Chairman Mao, the who was like Banquo's ghost. They're always around and yet not there, and the person you shouldn't mention. And he would like seem to pop up and yet wouldn't. And I went to his village because I had read in numerous books, among them a book called Chinese Shadows by Simon Leys, book that was very celebrated in the 70s, very gloomy book, but it was an attack more or less on what was happening in China in the early to mid-70s. Said that Shaoshan, which was Chairman Mao's birthplace, was visited by 100,000 people a day at times, and usually between 10 and 20,000. Say on a bad day, there'd be 20,000 people there, and on a good day, as many as 160,000 people there. And I thought, I've got to see this. I've got to see this. Because there was a railway there. They built a special railway from Changsha in the province of Hunan to the village where Mao was born. And much as we might, you know, build a railway to Mount Vernon or, you know, Springfield, Illinois, probably is one to Springfield, Illinois, but to carry the faithful who are going to pay their respects to the memory of Chairman Mao. And early one morning, I got the train, and I was very surprised that no one was on it. Well, I lied. There were maybe three people on it. I said, where are you going? And they said, we're going on a picnic. I said, what about Chairman Mao? They said, oh, yeah. Anyway, there was no one else on the train. No one else. And when I got to the village, it looked like the town that time had forgotten. The tide was out. You know, there's just nothing there. And I said to the woman, I didn't show her my little red book, but I said, I wanted to buy a copy of The Thoughts of Mao. She said, we don't have any. I said, what about a badge? No, nothing. The place was empty, and there was a big parking lot where that they had for buses that picked people up at the station and then took them to Mao's house. A very nice little villa. His father was a landlord or sort of a small landowner. Mao hated his father, and people think that the modern history of China was really about Mao's feelings for his father, his dislike for authority, his father's authority, and the fact that his father had a little money and was sort of a big man in this little town. There was no one in the town of Shaoshan. The people, they were selling bars of soap and needles and threads and keychains and so forth, but nothing. It was absolutely empty. And I thought, that is interesting, because 7 or 8 years ago it was different, and 10 or 15 years ago it was absolutely jumping. And it shows how it's a place where people went to have picnics. It also shows you, as well showed me, about the vanity of human wishes. Or, you know, this the poem Ozymandias by Shelley? I am Ozymandias, king of kings. I went to a distant land and I saw the poem. I'm paraphrasing it. Am I boring you with this paraphrase of the poem? But the sand covers this these stones, and then one of the stones reads, I am Ozymandias, king of kings. It just, the whole thing had turned to dust. And in a way, that was the memory of Mao. But something else had taken its place. I said that was one of the two most memorable things. And the last thing was going to Tibet and seeing how the Chinese, like many other people, like missionaries, evangelists, Americans in Vietnam, and British in Africa, or the British in India, like encyclopedia salesmen, they think, we're going to get this place on its feet, or we're going to, you know, wipe out the enemy and show these people what progress, civilization, and what it means to be modern. Faced with the Dalai Lama, Buddhists, and people who had not seen a motor vehicle until 1951, and had really no roads. But the Chinese went in, built, more or less deposed the Dalai Lama, drove him out, built factories, roads, schools, and barracks, army camps, and even in central Tibet, there's the place where they make nuclear warheads, and they might even test them there. And you see, on the one hand, the Chinese, it's presumably no bad thing to do. This is what progress and modern life is all about, building roads and getting people to line up and get off your knees and all of that. And the Tibetans, who would have been, it appeared to me, and from what people said, perfectly happy to exist that way. There was an absolute impasse. There were riots in Tibet not many months ago, I think about 2 or 3 months ago, and people were killed. And it shows that but the Chinese were doing really what we would urge them to do, to educate people, teach them to read, and to rid the country, I suppose, of a slave owners, freeing the slaves, because there were slaves in Tibet, as well as another class of people who just handled corpses. In Tibet, they put corpses out for birds to eat them. It's part of the great chain of being. But there were people who only did that. Anyway, the Chinese got rid of those people too, or that class of people. And looking at that, at the Chinese there, the soldiers, the factories, the schools and so forth, along with the monasteries that had been torn down and partly rebuilt and patched up, or during the Cultural Revolution turned into pigsties, which is much like taking the Vatican or Canterbury Cathedral or St. Patrick's in New York, and raising, putting animals in it. The sacrilege of it did not disturb the Chinese at all. They thought, this is the way forward. And I remember that in the middle of, this is at 12 or 13,000 feet, which is Lhasa's very high, and the white snow-capped mountains all around, and this strange little drama taking place on the plateau. And yet, even though that was a paradox and a puzzle to me as to what they should do, and was even very, very depressing, I thought, I had one thought on leaving China, and that was, please, please, let me come back. I hope I can come back to this place, because Tibet, which was the last of it, and a place where I really understood the Chinese, or understood the problems the Chinese faced, and the skills that they had that exemplified it, was a place that I would gladly go back to. And I thought that also I would be able to write something that I hadn't written before, that this was not a book about me, and not even a book about travel, about getting from place to place, but perhaps a book about worthy, good, compassionate, interesting, and complex people who, in spite of everything that people say, are not inscrutable. They were knowable people. And I think that's probably the thing that gave me the most satisfaction, the idea that the Chinese are people that we can know, and that to say that they're inscrutable is really not to be very fair to them at all. You've been very kind to listen this long, so I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
That was Paul Theroux speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1988. Theroux is an acclaimed travel writer and novelist. He is the author of over 47 books, including The Mosquito Coast and The Great Railway Bazaar. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.